What I'm going to do in a very brief time, and you can, somebody can, you know, tap me on the shoulder as I'm about to exceed my time, because I really want to talk very briefly about not so much. There's no one secular perspective on the topic of surrogate motherhood. There are many different perspectives that people who have written on this topic in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, I can't even count the number of articles and books that have been produced on the topic from many different vantage points. Some very supportive of the notion that women should be encouraged, if they wish, to gestate children for other people. Many supporting that they should be paid for their physical labor of gestating and going through labor and delivery. That they should be expected to keep their agreements with the people that they gestate children for. And if during the pregnancy or after the birth of a child, they come to regret that decision and want to retain custody of the child, there are many people who would say that that should not be the case. Back 20 years ago, the first very well-known case in the United States of surrogate motherhood, a case of Mary Beth Whitehead in New Jersey, a woman decided that she didn't want to relinquish custody of the child that she had gestated. And many people said a contract is a contract is a contract. She agreed. She signed a paper. She was paid a sum of money. She should give up the child. That's one perspective, and it's a perspective that features as its hallmarks the notion that women should be free, as any other people are, as women are in other domains, to make decisions about their bodies and their lives, to make contracts of what they will do, that they should not make these contracts without a very clear sense of what's going into them. They should only do this with a sense of informed consent, and that once they've made the contract, they should honor it. So it's a very autonomy-focused notion. And it's a notion that says that what women do with their bodies, that is, being pregnant, even though it is physically very involving work, doesn't have to mean that the physical involvement of pregnancy means the psychological involvement of wanting to be the mother, social mother, of the child that comes with after the pregnancy, of the child that results from the pregnancy. So it's a notion that separates physicality of gestation from the emotional commitments to rearing a child. Other perspectives stress that pregnancy is a very deeply involving activity, that women can't undertake it without changing their lives in certain ways to be to make sure that they guarantee the health of the fetus that they're carrying. They change their diets, they change their lifestyle. If they were coffee drinkers, they stopped drinking coffee. If they drank wine, they stopped drinking wine to be careful that the fetus doesn't have alcohol or caffeine that might endanger the fetus. And so what many people would say is that pregnancy and the gestation is very involving work. Women have to think about it a lot. And it's no wonder that women during the course of that gestation might change their minds about how disconnected they could be from the fetus after it's born. That once they see a real live baby, even if they originally intended to give it to someone else or surrender it to someone else, that they can feel a very deep connection to it. It's often known as bonding, but anyway. That women will feel a very deep connection to this child that they have brought to bear. That perspective says this is something that women shouldn't agree to in advance in a binding way, because like any other relationship, you might change your mind. Think of all the friendships you make that don't last. You start a friendship in goodwill and it changes. Who knows why? You can't promise that you will be friends with someone for life, even in marriage. Even when we take vows, I mean, people recognize that marital bonds, although they're undertaken with the expectation that they will continue for life, they don't always. Divorce is not looked on favorably, but it's not something that's impossible to happen, because human relationships are complicated and they don't always survive. Pregnancy is a kind of human relationship. A woman is interacting with the fetus. So this perspective stresses the kind of relationship that goes on, even if it's only in the mind of the pregnant woman, and says women might change their minds, and also says that it's something perhaps that women shouldn't be paid to do, that you aren't typically paid to form relationships of an intimate sort, and perhaps women shouldn't be paid to do this. If they want to do this as a voluntary act for someone they know or for someone they don't, perhaps they should, but that payment might be something that's really not good for women to do and not good for the children that result. Does a child want to find out later that the person who bore it was paid $10,000, $20,000, $40,000 to gestate that child? It might not be a very good feeling for that child. The other kinds of questions that we could talk about where there's a lot of debate are what kind of relationships the women who gestate children should have with the people who are raising children. Should they be family members? Some people think that family arrangements, if a sister gestates a child for another sister, that might be a good thing. We have stories of that in our... But there are many situations where those family relationships can be very complicated. The person who gestates a child for her sister may ultimately not feel that the sister is raising the child the way she would. How does it feel to know that you bore a child for someone else and then you don't like how the parent is raising the child? What kinds of family friction can this create? Should you be anonymous to the people who are receiving the child? Should you have any relationship with them, no relationship? Should the parents tell the child that the child came from someone who was not the rearing parents, that the child was gestated by someone else? That's another large question. Some people say, yes, you should always tell. There shouldn't be that kind of secret. Some people say, no, you shouldn't tell, that the people who are raising the child really are the true parents and the child doesn't need to know. Then there become more complicated questions about whether the surrogate is using her own egg, artificially inseminated with someone else's sperm, or whether she is gestating not with her egg but with the embryo of the couple who plan to raise the child. Does that make the psychological experience or the moral experience different? And then there are the very complicated questions in a system without universal health insurance, such as the one in the United States, without coverage for reproductive services of all sorts. This is not true in Israel, but it is true in the United States. Wealthy people can get access to reproductive technologies and surrogate motherhood. They have the money to pay, but the people who are not wealthy may not have the money. This is not supported by medical insurance. There are no government subsidies for people who want to hire surrogate mothers. Should there be? That's a very big question. The reason that some people would say that there should is that it would make surrogacy available to other people who are unable to carry children themselves and want to be parents. People who say they shouldn't would say, first of all, there are many problems with these reproductive technologies, and it is not medically necessary to become a parent. It might be something that people want, but nobody has to do it in order to live. And there's no reason that health insurance funds that are limited should subsidize that when we don't subsidize a lot of other things that people need in order to survive. So another large question in the whole surrogacy debate and reproductive technology debate is what kind of government support or health insurance support should there be for this activity? There are other issues. We could talk about this for hours, but that is, if not a secular perspective, it's a view of many different questions that people in the field of bioethics would talk about when they talk about surrogate motherhood. Relationships, access to the technology, whether people should be able to change their mind, whether autonomy should reign, what kinds of, how should we resolve custody disputes, whether payment should be done for this service. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The last time I spoke at the student Medical Ethics Society, I gave a class on PGD. It was in 501. Of course, there was dinner beforehand. And around 2 months ago or so, a student came over to me and said to me, I get a mazel tov, I got engaged. I didn't really know who the student was. I wished him mazel tov, and then asked them with a little bit of chutzpah, you know, it's very nice that you got engaged, but why are you telling me this? I don't really know who you are. The student explained to me that he met the person that he got engaged to at the PGD lecture over dinner. So I'm looking to bat 1,000 here, guys. Okay? So my office is on the first floor, first hall, and I hope at least two of you come to me in the very near future. Also, I'd like to thank Dr. Ash not only for her unbelievable, insightful remarks that she made today, tonight, but the clarity of vision that she brings to the ideal of ethics. You may not be aware of this, and you should be. Dr. Ash is a world-class ethicist. Nothing that she talked about was secular. Everything that she talked about was holy. And her capacity to be able to share those ideals and to set them up for us in ways in which we can look at them through the prism of Jewish thought, contrast and compare it to the prism of other value systems is totally kodesh, is totally holy, and in no way is ever secular. I want to thank her for the cogent way in which she shared some very important issues in such a short period of time. I prepared some sources. They're there for you. Let's begin and share some Torah for the next half hour or so. The first page of our handout. The first page of our handout starts with a very important midrash that I've shared with some of you in the past, and that is the recognition of the fact that God did not create a perfect world. God, in fact, created an imperfect world. The Midrash about the whole notion of why there is the notion of circumcision. God wished that we have partners, and those partners that God wished is humankind. And while God creates an imperfect world, it's up to us to help perfect the world. We say that every single time we daven, L'taken olam v'machut shakai. We're here to be involved in tikkun olam. Clearly medicine, clearly the idea of surrogacy, the whole idea of any form of artificial insemination, of actualizing the gift of a couple having children, clearly that is a celebration of the capacity for us to be able to be partners with God through the use of the gift of science. This idea is also highlighted in the Gemara in Bava Batra on page 10a in Bava Batra. The Gemara discusses a very famous dialogue between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. Turnus Rufus was the Roman general, the Roman governor of Judea, and Rabbi Akiva represented the Jewish people prior to the destruction of Beitar in 135 CE. Ternus Rufus says to Rabbi Akiva, the Jewish people are condemned to Gehenim, are condemned to hell, because they help the poor. Because suppose a king, an earthly king, incarcerated one of his subjects and said that no one can help this person, no one can give this person food or drink. If someone snuck food or drink to this person, would not the king be upset? And you, the Jewish people, are called the servants of God. Kili b'nei Yisrael avadayim. Therefore suggesting that the Jewish people, by helping the poor, are condemned to transgressing the will of God. Rabbi Akiva responded, suppose an earthly king incarcerated not one of his subjects, but his child, and said no one is to give his child food or drink. And then somebody snuck in some food or drink. Would not the king be happy that his son was saved? And we are called we are also called the children of God. Banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. Rabbi Soloveitchik once explained the difference between Ternus and Rufus and Rabbi Akiva and this Gemara in the following ideal. When somebody is going through a difficult time, when somebody is going through a challenge, when somebody has their fate set out for them, they're poor. In our case, they can't have children. How are we supposed to look at that? Ternus Rufus says you're supposed to wear the glasses of God. God willed that these people should be poor. You help bring them out of poverty, you're condemned to hell. Rabbi Akiva says, it is not our job to wear the glasses of God. We don't look at things through the glasses of God, because simply we don't understand God's approach. It's our job to be God's partners. And if we can empower somebody to remove them from poverty, we should be able to. And we should celebrate that. If a couple wishes to actualize their dream of having children, then we should support that dream through the gifts that science have given us. And we should not look at this as changing destiny to the point in which we can't, that we don't have a right to get involved with that, but rather a celebration of the notion of tikkun olam. In the 1100s or so, the Meiri in Sanhedrin has a very famous comment where the Meiri says, in his definitions of what is witchcraft and magic that is forbidden, the Meiri makes the following statement. Source number 3. Kosha hu nasa bepula tivit eno beklal kshafim. One should know that anything that is done through science is not considered magic. Afilu, says the Meiri, Yedu livroa briut yafot shelo mizvug hamin, kemo shenoda b'sifri hateva she'ein hadavar nimna. Even when, as we know from Kabbalistic literature, that there will come a time in which we'll learn how to create human beings without having a sexual relationship. This is in the 1100s. Says the Meiri, Rishayim lasot, it's permitted to do this. Shekosha hu tivi, anything that is considered through science, eino b'klal kishuf. V'domeleza amru, this is what it means, koshi yesh bo mishum refuah, anything that comes through the natural process of medicine, ein bo mishum darkei amori, is not considered an Amorite action, which is forbidden. So while we have just in my introduction indicated the capacity to celebrate if a couple wishes the gift of being able to have children, it is not a halachic mandate that a couple that cannot have children in the natural course of a relationship, they don't have to find these scientific ways in order to be able to have children. At the end of 120 years, the Talmud says there's a list of questions that are asked of every single person. One of them is, Sipita Yeshua, did you wait for the Yeshua? Did you wait for the redemption of humankind? One of the other questions is, Asakta Beperia Verivia. A sakta b'peri v'rivia doesn't mean did you have children, because that the language would have been kiyamta peri v'rivia. It says a sakta b'peri v'rivia, did you try to have children? Sometimes you can try to have children and it works, and sometimes it does not. one is not halachically mandated to use the gifts of science, which comes with a lot of challenges, financial, that Dr. Ash mentioned, other challenges that Dr. Ash mentioned, psychological challenges, etc., etc., one is not required to do so. One sees that idea from a Tosfot in Pesachim, where the Tosfot says that if a person is uncircumcised, while he cannot eat from the Paschal sacrifice, he is not required to go through a formal operation above and beyond the normal brit, the normal circumcision, in order to be able to eat the Paschal sacrifice. God does not require one to take what we would call heroic measures above and beyond what is considered normal in order to be able to fulfill commandments. And that is particularly true with the idea of having children. However, should one decide to do that, should a couple decide to do that, then there are certain issues. And what I would like to do in the remaining time that I have is share with you, in contrast with you, because I think it's important, the notion of paternity and maternity. It's very hard to discuss surrogacy without contrasting it to the notion of paternity, and there's some exciting ideas in both of them. And so we'll spend a few minutes on the definition of paternity, and then we'll move our focus, which will be, I think, amplified by understanding the paternity in the notion of surrogacy. So if we turn to the next page of our handout, source 5, we'll notice that there's a pasuk, there's a verse in Esther that speaks about the idea that Esther had no parents. Ki ein la av ve'ein, and then it goes on further in the same verse, ubamos avia ve'ima, when her father and mother died, Mordechai took her as a child. The Gemara immediately asks why the need to repeat twice in the same verse that she did not have parents. The Gemara answers, that's source 6, in order to accentuate the point that her mother died immediately during childbirth and her father died at the point of conception. She never knew her parents. This idea highlights immediately that the parents are called parents simply by being involved in the natural act, even if they were not involved with raising the child. But in focusing on paternity, perhaps the most important Gemara is in source number 7, where the Talmud in Chagiga is trying to create a paradigm. It's important before we introduce this Gemara to understand that the greatness of the Talmud is that it doesn't always focus on real live events as much as it does in creating halachic paradigms so one can learn principles through which one can build up an ethical approach or a Jewish legal approach to certain issues. The Talmud here asks the following question. A high priest is not allowed to marry anybody who had sexual relations, whether the woman is divorced or widowed. A kohen, a regular kohen, cannot marry a divorcee, but can marry somebody who was widowed. So Ben Zoma was further asked, may a high priest marry a virgin, someone who's never had relations, who has become pregnant? That's in our Gemara. Okay? So that's the question. So there's a whole give and take. Maybe it looks like she didn't really have relations, but she really still had relations. The Gemara answers, no. There is the possibility that she never had relations, but she conceived in a bath. In other words, there is this idea, and again, I don't think the Gemara means it in an exacting way, there is this idea that maybe what the Gemara is highlighting, that one can bifurcate the sexual act and the concept of being pregnant. When the Gemara introduces that paradigm, it is trying to show you the difference between the gavra, the relationship, and the status quo of the woman. And the Gemara now highlights for the first time this notion of a woman becoming pregnant without having a sexual relationship. If you look at source 9, Rav Shmuel Feivish, the Beit Shmuel, on the left-hand side, indicates that based on this Gemara, that any single time a woman becomes pregnant without having a sexual relationship, the sperm donor is considered the father for all things. In fact, again, the sources are here for you to read in your free time during reading week. And that is, Ma'aviv, if you see what I have underlined, Ma'aviv nishma dahave b'no l'chol davar. That it is considered the father simply by having donated the sperm, even if there is no sexual act at all. If you turn to the next page, the Tashbates in the 1300s, I'm not going to go through the whole tshuva, amplifies Rav Shmuel Feivish and says the same thing. A sperm donor, even without a sexual relationship, is considered the father. The definition of paternity is the definition of the genetic donor. The Minchas Yitzchak, who is not known for his left-wing or modern Orthodox tendencies, who is the head of the Beis Din of the Eidah Haredes, but I must say is one of the greatest poskim of the past generation. The Minchas Yitzchak speaks about a situation in which a person has a limited sperm count, and then in order to be able to have children with his spouse, does an IUI, an intrauterine insemination. I'm always uncomfortable speaking about these terms, especially in front of experts like Dr. Ash, but to simplify what an intrauterine insemination is, instead of the sperm having to go through the traveling through the endocervical canal, the entire area up to the fallopian tube, the sperm is put in a syringe and basically shot into the woman's womb and essentially placed at the entrance of the fallopian tube. Because, just to explain this in layman's terms, when the sperm travels to the fallopian tubes, it's like traveling on the FDR drive. There's a lot of potholes along the way, and it kills a lot of the sperm. So if you don't have a strong sperm count, or your sperm is not, even though normally millions of sperm are ejaculated, if there isn't enough sperm, so what can happen is you might be able to have children because of all the potholes along the way, the sperm are destroyed, and therefore none reach the fallopian tube to fertilize the egg. Along comes the notion of an intrauterine insemination and says, no need to travel on the FDR drive. We'll create a flyover where there are no potholes. And we'll deposit the sperm at the entrance of the fallopian tube. So essentially, there is no need for the sperm to be compromised along its route to the fallopian tubes. The Minchas Yitzchak, therefore, says that in any case of an IUI, of an intrauterine insemination, Pshita li dekayim ha-mitzvah, they've definitely fulfilled the mitzvah pru revu, and of course, the child is considered the child of the husband, l'chol davar, for everything, even though there was no sexual act whatsoever. His only concern that he mentions is, we want to make sure, and this was in the news in the past six weeks or so, we want to make sure that since the sperm defines paternity, you want to make sure that there's certain hashkacha, there's certain supervision in the labs. Why? Because you want to make sure that people don't insert sperm into the woman or fertilize an egg of a woman through IVF, in vitro fertilization. IVF is a procedure in which you harvest an egg, you fertilize that egg within the laboratory itself. There's different forms of IVF. There's what's called ICSI IVF, there's regular IVF. For our conversation, IVF is simply in vitro fertilization. You fertilize the egg within the lab, and in the blastocyst stage of development, third or fourth day after the egg is fertilized, it is then returned to the womb of the woman. So he's very concerned that if there's not proper hashkacha, then what can happen is you won't know which sperm is used. If you don't know which sperm is used, then you really won't know who the father is. So the Minchas Yitzchak requires, and this is standard protocols in halacha, that there be some hashkacha within the fertility lab. And even though there are strict rules and regulations, which Dr. Ash probably could speak with greater clarity than I could, the halakha requires some type of OU supervision, so to say, within the labs also. That's not a joke. That's what halakha requires. And Cornell does it. Others do it. Maimonides does it. They all have hashkacha. They all have hashkacha. So if you turn to the next source, so we see that this notion of definition of paternity is the sperm donor. So much so that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein both conclude the following idea. that what happens if the husband and the wife wish to have children, but the husband has no sperm? Even through fine needle aspiration and other ways of removing the sperm in a more aggressive way, you can't remove any sperm. Where should you get sperm donation from? So since the definition of paternity is the sperm donor, both Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman suggest that the sperm donor should be from a non-Jew. Because if the sperm donor is from a Jew, we're worried about the issue of Shema Yisa Basa Choso. We're afraid that what could happen is that, you know, Yankel will donate his sperm, and what will happen is the child will be born, Mazel Tov, and the child's going to go out with somebody else that Yankel donated sperm to, or Yankel's own child that he raised in his own home. And what could happen is you could be marrying halakhically your brother or your sister, Shema Yisa Basa Choso. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, use sperm from a non-Jew, so the person does not have a halachic father, but he has a father, the father who's raising him, and that's the way it should be done. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says the same thing. So if you look at the next page, source 12, you'll see that Rav Shlomo Zalman has a few things, some of them we're not getting into. One is, he says, you can inseminate the wife through IUI, that's the flyover over the FDR, just to remind you, even when the woman is a nida, because since there's no sexual act, there's no concerns over those issues. Then he says that if you have to use sperm, I'm not saying that he endorses it with a full embrace, because he has some issues about it. He says that if you should use a non-Jew. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in two different tshuvot, highlights that you should use a non-Jew. Rav Moshe Feinstein's house was actually firebombed for this tshuva by a sect within the Orthodox community that was not happy with Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva and therefore refused to accept it and thought that they should make their feelings known and therefore firebombed his house. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's house was not firebombed. One could ask, why? Why did Rav Moshe get the privilege of his house being firebombed as opposed to Rav Shlomo Zalman's? The answer is that Igros Moshe is a much more popular sefer than the first volume of Noam that was probably only three people in this room ever heard of prior to tonight. So in other words, Noam, where Rav Shlomo Zalman has a very long tshuva, is not really well known. The Igros Moshe, which was, you know, is on the SOY hit parade, sperm sale, you know, sold all the time. Noam, I haven't found at any of the SOY sperm sales. The point being that they both follow the same thing. The most exciting thing about the paternity piece, and I promise you that this will also help us with the maternity piece, is an unbelievable idea that is found in the 1700s in the Noda Behuda. And the reason why I'm sharing this with you is I just want to show you how when we come to modern day halakhic issues, we can build on paradigms that are set up even in the 1700s. Rav Yecheskel Landau, the Noda Behuda in 13a, asked the following question. We know that there's a notion of afkana, that if a woman is widowed and she is childless, she waits 3 months before either she gets married to somebody else or has to go through chalitza to see if she is pregnant from the first husband. The Noda Behuda says, why do you wait 90 days? You should wait 93 days. After all, what could have happened is the following. They had relations, and then he passed away. It takes 3 days for the sperm to reach the fallopian tube. It's a lot of traffic on that FDR drive thing. It takes 3 days. In fact, the Gemara says that, and science recognizes that also. It could take 3 days for the sperm to fertilize the egg in the fallopian tube. So you should wait 3 days until the egg gets fertilized, and then 90 days. Wait 93 days in order to be able to tell whether the woman is pregnant or not, not just 90. Most Achronim ask this question. They say 90 is a rounded off number. The Noda Behuda has an unbelievable chiddush. The Noda Behuda says that the following. If the woman, it's an unbelievable statement by the Noda Behuda, if the woman is inseminated, but the husband dies before the time of conception, but was inseminated before he died, even though she could become pregnant with the sperm of her dead husband, she still goes through the process of chalitza, because at the moment of death, the pasuk reads, "Ubein ein lo," that there is no child at that moment. So since at the moment of death, there was no conception, she could go through chalitza. So you can have a case, according to the Nosh Behuda, that the woman could be 5 months pregnant, but the conception happened posthumously. In other words, they had relations, he died, conception happened 2 days later. According to the Nosh Behuda, that woman would go through the process of chalitza, because at the moment of death, there was no conception. Then the Nosh Behuda says the piece that's important for us. However, even though the woman goes through the process of chalitza, it's important to recognize that this child is still considered the child of the father because he's a sperm donor, l'chol davar. That means if the father was a kohen, he's a kohen. If the father had real estate in millions of dollars, so then the child gets it. Even though the woman has to go through chalitza, he says it's a diyuk in the pasuk. But the point that's important for us here is that the note of Yehuda introduces an idea known as posthumous paternity. You can have, in our contemporary situation, a person that expresses sperm, freezes it for 20 years, for 30 years, for 2 years, for 100 years, and then that sperm is injected into a spouse or into another woman. The halacha, and the guy could be dead at the point in which the sperm is injected. The guy was a soldier somewhere, expressed sperm, and the wife who's widowed says, "I want to remember my husband who was the hero. I want to have a child. I want to take that sperm that was expressed, defrost it, and be injected with it, and all of a sudden have a child posthumously." So according to the Nosh Behuda, he gets Yerusha, he gets the inheritance. If the father was a Kohen, he's a Kohen. He probably has to observe a yahrzeit for a father that was never around for conception, let alone for his life. It's an unbelievable paradigm that the Nosh Behuda highlights. The next page of the source, the Keren Ha'orah, basically disagrees with the Nosh Behuda, and he says that, "I agree with you about the notion of posthumous paternity. I just don't think a woman who conceives at any point from her husband, even if conception happened after death, goes through chalitza. I disagree with that point." But the point he does agree on is the notion of conception. With that in mind, if you turn to the next page, 13c, you'll see that Rav Shaul Yisraeli is furious that in one of the newspapers of Hatzofeh, a group of poskim said that the story that I just gave you, that if a person had expressed sperm, died, and now that sperm is inserted within a woman, that the dead father, the dead person is the father, the chol davar, using this note of Yehuda. So the Rabbanim in Israel paskin that based on this note of Yehuda and the Keren Ha'orah, they paskin, they follow the halacha that a person can conceive posthumously. Rav Shaul Yisraeli disagreed with this. Rav Shaul Yisraeli said that the Nosh Behuda is not a good paradigm, because in the Nosh Behuda's case, there was no actions left to be done after the husband died. The sperm was already within the woman at the point that he died, so that's when the Nosh Behuda said it's good. But in our case, in which you have to defrost the sperm, again, I'm defining this in lay terms, there are more scientific terms to define it, but I'm using just lay terms, defrost the sperm and then inject the sperm within the womb of the woman, that requires too much work, says the Nosh Behuda, to allow that person to become a posthumous father. The jury is still out on this idea. Some disagree with Shaul Yisraeli and they say, why is one considered more effort than the other? In both cases, the sperm was removed from the husband before he passed away. The bottom line that I want to show you is that it is clear that the genetic donor, when it comes to the definitions of paternity, is the father, so much so that you have a chronim from the 1700s who are willing to suggest that even if that donation happens posthumously, that the person is still considered the father. Now, how does that compare to the notion of maternity? There, we have four different approaches. The jury is still out. In fact, I had the opportunity to ask Rabbi Shechter today. I said, "You know, Rebbe, I'm about to give this class. Can you tell me how you feel about the issue?" He says, it's machlokas in the poskim, the jury's still out. It's machlokas in the poskim. So, I want to share with you the four different approaches. Two we're going to just mention, and then two we're going to go through in a little bit more depth. One says there's no such, in the case of a surrogate, that means, in our simplistic definition of that, that the egg is donated, the egg is a donation from one woman, and the host mother, the one who is nurturing the fetus, is another woman. One woman donates the genetics, another woman hosts the fertilized eggs. And in that case, you have a host mother and a genetic mother. So some say there is no mother, because there's no mother doing the full job. Others say that there are two mothers. Those are not normative approaches. The normative approaches that are found in Psach are either that the genetic mother is the mother, or the host mother, the one who is doing all the work that Dr. Ash articulated. So clearly, the one that is nurturing, the one who's creating that bond, that is the mother. As opposed to the father, where there's only one paradigm, and that is a genetic gift, and therefore there's not really much to discuss, so therefore the genetic giver is the father. When it comes to the mother, if it can be bifurcated, so then there are posts that say the one who does the nurturing should be considered the mother. That is the most normative approach, that the definition of maternity is the one, the host mother. But there are major poskim, including the Eda Charedis, the basin of the Eda Charedis, and Rav Gorin, who both say that it is genetic donor. This is probably the only time that Rav Gorin and the Eda Charedis agree on anything, but it's that they both agree on this issue. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to show you some of the approaches in this issue. Let's look at Source 14. Source 14 is a very famous Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel. I would not normally use this Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel because it's a Gadata, and you really shouldn't use a Gadata to define halacha, but it's important to recognize, if you turn to the next page, Source 17, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, a major posek in Israel of the past generation, used this Targum as the core of his approach. So I just bring it down, not because I'm an advocate of using a Gadata, but in the spirit of intellectual honesty, to show that Rav Shaul Yisraeli used this. What is this Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel? The Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says that when Leah was pregnant with, here's the clue, when Leah was pregnant with Yosef, Rachel was pregnant with Dinah. I know, I'm happy you're perplexed. That's exactly what I was looking for. At least one person would be perplexed. What does that mean? The Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says initially, Leah was pregnant with Yosef, Rachel was pregnant with Dinah. Leah realized that she was carrying a male, and that Rachel was carrying a female, and that means that Rachel would contribute less to the creation of the 12 tribes than any of the other personalities within Yaakov's family structure. So the Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says the following. Look at Source 14, where I have underlined. Ushmiya min kadam Hashem saluta de Leah, that God heard the prayers of Leah, the isachu ubraya, and there was a change within the fetuses, b'mehon, from one womb to another womb, v'havayasid Yosef b'masa de Rachel, and Yosef was then switched and put into the womb of Rachel, v'dina b'ma'asa de Leah, and Dina was put into the womb of Leah. Hope I've ended your perplexity here. So, says the Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel, we never hear that anyone would ever say that the mother of Yosef is Leah. We always hear that the mother of Yosef is Rachel. But who donated the gamete? Who donated the genetics for Yosef? It was Leah who donated it. Leah gave the genetic gift, and according to this Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel, it was the host mother was Rachel. This is a proof, says Rav Shaul Yisraeli, this Agadata, which again, is not the normative way in which we answer Psak Halacha. This is the proof that the definition of maternity is the host mother, not the genetic donor. Source 16, we'll get to 15, source 16 is a comment by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal, where Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said the following: if you have a choice between defining who the mother is, between the genetic donor and the host mother, it makes sense that you define the mother that is dealing with the fetus post 40 days. Because there is a concept within Jewish tradition that pre-40 days, a fertilized egg is not yet even considered a fetus, it is considered maya ba'alma, a sack of water. That is why it is clear within halakhic literature that not only is it permitted to be involved with stem cell research, it should be encouraged. So since there is this notion in halakha that the first 40 days of a fertilized egg, it's still considered a sack of water, so therefore the mother that was involved in the fertilized egg, in the development of the fetus in the first 40 days, namely the genetic donor, should not be considered the mother, especially when there is a woman who is involved with the development of the fetus post 40 days. He goes so far to say that you should view the genetic mother or the genetic mother's gift as totseret Japan. Simply just view the egg as made in Japan. Do not in any way associate the genetic mother whatsoever with this fetus. That is very important, because then it allows the genetic donor not to be a Jew. Because if Judaism defines the Jewish identity by the mother, if the genetic giver plays no role in that, then, as Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says with great clarity, in fact, you'll see in source 16, you can see the last few words in his in the sixth line. He says, "Kel Homer Syntheti, treated as," or by the way, or we actually can look at that whole line. We count six lines from the top after the first word. She'ein li yaches lebeitzit hanitremet. You should not relate to the genetic gift yoter ma'asher ke'el chomer syntheti tetzeret Japan, no different than a synthetic material that says made in Japan. V'kein vad hanolal yisraelit mitrumat beitzit shogaya ein sarek geirus afilu l'chomra. Therefore, a child born to a surrogate mother who has a genetic gift from a non-Jew doesn't need geirus. It's a simple waste of time even to do geirus at all. This idea about the definition of the mother being the surrogate, the host mother, is also found in a much more complicated approach in the Gemara in Yevamos. This Gemara in Yevamos is fully developed, for those who want to do serious research in this, in an article by Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg in Tchumim, the fifth volume. An exceptionally important volume on the notion of surrogacy. There are several articles in there that anyone who really wants to be holding in these issues must go through. They are very, very complicated articles. But Baruch Hashem, we are blessed both at Stern and at Yeshiva with Talmidei Chachamim that you can turn to for guidance in any of these articles. Let's look at the source 15. Okay? Source 15 says the following. Come in here. Twin brothers who were converts. What's the halacha? The halacha is a ger is kekatan shenolad dami. A ger is as if they have been born anew. So if a family decides to convert after the children have been born, halachically, although there should still be a relationship, halachically, there is a severing of the relationship between the parents and the children, even if they all convert. There is a severing of all relationships. You're like reborn. What happens if a woman converts when she's pregnant? So the Mishnah says there is some severing between those fetuses and the father. Some severing on certain halakhic issues. Why is that? Because the minute you go into the mikveh, any relationships that have been fully established are severed in some level. So since the father's relationship has been severed because he's already donated the sperm and defined his paternity, that relationship is severed on some level. But the Gemara says the relationship between the mother and the children and the fetuses remains even if the woman immerses when she's pregnant. Says Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, why is it that the father's relationship is severed and the mother's relationship is not? He says it's for obvious reasons. The father's relationship with the children has already been established by giving the genetic gift of the sperm. The mother's relationship is evolving because her relationship is defined by the nurturing of the fetuses within her womb. And therefore, when she immerses, when she's pregnant, the relationship has not yet been fully established, therefore there is no relationship to sever. For that reason, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg says, it is clear to me that the definition of maternity is not the genetic giver, but rather it is the surrogate mother. A source that I did not bring down, and that is Rav Yashiv, who is not a fan of doing IVF. He's not a fan. He's concerned about a lot of issues. But Rav Yashiv says, if it was already done, the definition of the mother, it's brought down in the Nishmas Avram, for those who are interested. He says, if it was already done, then the definition of the mother is the host mother, the surrogate mother. This idea is highlighted by Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, but there are others that disagree. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, in the spirit, and this is a very important issue, this is what's known as the fifth Shulchan Aruch. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg was concerned about the following. There are great Jewish thinkers that think that the definition of the mother should be no different than the definition of the father, the genetic gift. And there are great Jewish thinkers that say the definition should be the host mother. What happens if the genetic giver is non-Jewish? So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg says, according to my philosophy, like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, there should be no need for conversions. But he says the following. There's a whole group of Jewish thinkers that say the definition of the mother is the genetic donor. There's a whole group of thinkers like that. I don't want to create babies that are only kosher according to one approach. I don't want it to be like you know, some people only use the OU, some people only use the Chaf K, some people only use the Star K, that all of a sudden we're going to have babies that are going to be written on their forehead, kosher only according to this rabbi, non-Jewish according to this rabbi. I don't want that. I don't want it to be that you have little Jews walking around, and this one had a surrogate mother that was non-Jewish but had a genetic Jewish mother, and therefore, according to a group of poskim, without conversion, this kid isn't Jewish, and this kid had a Jewish surrogate mother but a non-Jewish genetic donor, and therefore, according to some poskim, the kid's Jewish. According to some other poskim, the kid's not Jewish. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg says, even though I believe that the definition of maternity is the host mother, any time the genetic mother is not Jewish, conversion should be done mi safek. Without any blessings, conversion should be done. And then, because we're at the cutting edge of this issue, the issue has not yet been dealt with, in 20 years from now when the child gets married, or depending which community they're in 18 years now, when the child gets married, whatever it is, 25 years, 30 years, whatever, I'm not trying to put any pressure on anybody, despite my introductory comment. Whenever the right time is, b'shat tova u'mitzlachat, then we'll decide whether that conversion was necessary or not, because there are halachic ramifications of who you can marry based on the fact whether that conversion was necessary or not. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is trying to basically have his cake and eat it also. And quite honestly, in the many cases that I was involved in with this issue, I always followed Rav Zalman Nechemya. It simply just makes sense to be able to create a way in which you have the largest bandwidth. So, in conclusion, we've discussed the notion that halacha celebrates the gift of science and how important that gift is. We've discussed the definition of paternity meaning being the genetic donor. We've discussed the issue of perhaps that genetic donor can even be a posthumous donor and still have that relationship. And then we discussed the issue of the definition of maternity. And in the case of maternity, where the genetic donor and the host who nurtures the fetus can be two different personalities, there is a split within the post in four ways. One say if you don't have all in one person, there's no mother. Others say if you have two different contributors, they're both considered halakhically mothers. You have to sit Shiva for both, you know, after 120 years. And then the normative approach is that it is the host mother, but a recognition that there's a substantial group that says it is the genetic donor. So you have those people like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who despite that exclude and do not want to incorporate the genetic group at all. And then you have others like Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who wish to create a larger bandwidth, and therefore they suggest that if the genetic donor is not Jewish, that misafek, that you should do a conversion without blessings, but a conversion l'chum. Thank you very much. Question. It seems I actually gave a 2.5 hour class on that issue to the rabbis at the Yarchikala, just on that one issue. It would seem that if there's no issues of intimacy, if there was no intimacy whatsoever between the man and the woman, that you do not create mamzerut. Mamzerut requires intimacy between the man and the woman. So if a woman is married and you do not use non-Jewish sperm, that's why Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman want you to use non-Jewish sperm. But if you would say you use Jewish sperm, while you might have an issue of not knowing who the father is, the child would not be considered a mamzer because there was not a physical relationship between the man and the woman, and that defines an issue of mamzerut. Does that answer the question?
Does everybody agree with that?
No, not everyone agrees with it. There are some poskim that say that even without a sexual relationship, no one ever agrees on everything. But it's really the normative approach. And even in the summary that I gave to you, I mean, you have Rav Shlomo Zalman is, you know, Rav Shlomo Zalman is a heavyweight. By the way, I did bring you the source from Rav Yashiv, and that's on the back page, page 20. But to give you the source that you asked about, if you look at source 12, you'll see that in the middle there, it says, Isser gomer lahazria mizera shel isha cher l'toch eshes ish shemi yisa choso v'gam nira shavlad hanola mazrav zu hu suffik mamzer. But he says ulam ein hazra'a chashuva g'znut. It's really not znut because of the fact that there is not a sexual intimate relationship. That's the normative approach. There is one daya in the Rishonim that says you don't need it, but the 99.9% of the postim don't follow that. So I would say, at best as there ever is, there is consistency on that issue. It's one of the Rishonim. You'll excuse me if I forgot who it is, but if you email me, I will PDF the source to you.
Thank you for that question. That was a good question to ask before mine. Actually, mine sort of follows that same train of thought. But what I want to
That's a good question. So you're at. Okay, no, you're. Okay.
One other sub question to that is, though, we're talking about siblings, and it doesn't really matter when children grow up whether that sibling is biological. Luckily, I have found in my own family for various reasons, which I can speak to that afterwards, but there are very, very serious issues here that seem to be ignored and are upsetting.
Okay, well, I'm sorry about the last piece, and I'm more than welcome to discuss it with you, and clearly discussing this issue in 45 minutes is, doesn't allow us to drill deeply on all the different issues, rather to touch on the surface. However, removing the emotional components to this, which are very deep and important to be dealt with, and therefore these issues need to be dealt with when we're dealing with it, not from our conversation, but rather from a halakhic perspective, they need to be dealt with on a one-on-one with the sensitivities that you're articulating. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein asked that question, but how do you know that the sperm is definitely going to come from a non-Jew? So the answer is that if the sperm bank is essentially based in areas in which there is rov, the vast majority of the inhabitants are non-Jewish, you can consider the sperm to be non-Jewish sperm. And Rav Moshe Feinstein is willing, that's why we stand on shoulders of great individuals, he's willing to defend that, even if there is a percentage of a chance that it would be Jewish sperm, he is willing to discount that issue once you have the notion of Rove. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now that particular issue is not seen in the small section of the source that I gave you from Rav Moshe Feinstein, but should you look at that tshuva that is cited, you will see that he deals with that issue that you brought up. I think it would be considered that they fulfill the mitzvah of priority. My point is that one is not halakhically obligated, even if they have money or they don't have money, one is not halakhically obligated to go through. This is where the psychological issues are equally as important. Doing issues of surrogacy, I don't care how much money you have in the bank, is a psychologically draining, challenging issue. It's not a walk in the park. Not only for the surrogate, but for the couple, especially in a case where the couple, with a woman, in order to be able to harvest the appropriate amount of follicles, she'll have to take some significant hormonal therapy to trick the body into ovulating more than one, several at the same time, in order to make sure that the process can happen effectively. Halakha does not require one to go through the psychological trauma and the medical trauma in order to be able to fulfill the mitzvah using IVF, surrogacy. If you wish to, it can celebrate that. But my point was, that simply by trying to have a child through the natural way, one has fulfilled one's necessary capacity, one does not need to use these measures in order to do it. You're halakhically, you can, but you're not mandated to. There's an important difference between those two. Oh, have they fulfilled the mitzvah of period review? That's a great question. I don't know the answer. I know. I would assume not, but I don't know. Good question.
Okay, we're going to take one last question. We're not going to have any last discussion.
Yeah. It's Ben or Bas. Yeah, it's Ben or Bas. It's Ben or Bas. Yeah. It's definitely not one or the other. So you don't have to worry. No, it's Ben or Bas. I mean, whether you like it in Hebrew or not, a lot of times when you speak in general about something, you'll use one gender more than the other. But it's definitely Ben or Bas. It's not just one or the other. So if you read, so this is the challenge of taking a 30-page article and only giving you 5 lines. I think if you read through the article, you would see in most of the places he switches back and forth. It just so in my case, where I wanted to cheat and just give you some of the summary pieces, he does not. And you know, I'm not into doctoring the language to making it politically appropriate, but he means both. Thank you. IUI. Pre-med, we can't let them make that mistake. Okay.
Just a quick question. Is there a restriction on the metadata of extractions from the
halacha? That's an unbelievably great question. That halacha, if you need to extract sperm, how do you do it? Let me just say like this. That is not a topic that I feel comfortable discussing in this forum like this. But just to let you know that there are protocols that are discussed. There are actually different protocols that are found actually in some of the Batei Dinim in Yerushalayim versus some of the Batei Dinim in Bnei Brak. You know, my training on these issues is Israel-centric, not United States-centric. So I use those as my points of reference. There are differences. Clearly, let me just, clearly we try to make sure that the sperm is expressed without in any ways compromising the integrity of the sperm in the most natural way possible. So if we can do it in a way in which the husband can have relations with his wife and still be able to capture the sperm in an appropriate way, that would be the best way. If we can't, then there are protocols how to do it, in trying to do it in the most natural way possible. But the overarching goal is tsniut. The overarching goal is to focus on the end game, and that is to be able to have appropriate and as many gametes as possible in order to be able to, for the couple to be able to have children.